These ladies certainly know what's what, and they aren't shy about letting us know what they think. And they're filled with know-how, too. They love sharing practical tips with us for our daily lives, and maybe even for the sake of our souls. These are the church ladies we meet in the novels of Barbara Taylor, who opens her new novel, All Waiting Is Long, in this way.
When Izzy passed on, it seemed fitting to christen ourselves the Isabel Lumley Bible Class. After all, she was the one who came up with the idea for our Wednesday women's scripture meetings. At least that's how she told it. Those of us who were there from the beginning remember different, but no sense beating that drum again. Let the dead rest is what we say. Besides, Izzy left enough money to Providence Christian Church to erase any hard feelings and repair the crumbling steeple. A Bible verse or two and a potluck lunch make for an edifying afternoon, and a much-needed one, given the moral decline we see today. Gambling, joyriding, bootlegging, not to mention the goings-on in the alleys downtown, a regular red-light district. Our very own Sodom and Gomorrah, right here in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Surely we're glimpsing the end times.
Barbara Taylor introducing us to the church ladies who will accompany us through the story we're about to experience. Just a few moments later, in fact, the church ladies will be the ones who first mention Violet and Lily, sisters so central to the novel All Waiting Is Long. It's the sequel to Barb Taylor's best-selling debut novel, Sing in the Morning, Cry at Night, and the latest volume in Akashic's Kaylee Jones book imprint. We learn from Akashic that All Waiting Is Long tells the stories of the Morgan sisters, a study in contrasts. In 1930, 25-year-old Violet travels with her 16-year-old sister, Lily, from Scranton to the Good Shepherd Infant Asylum in Philadelphia, so Lily can deliver her illegitimate child in secret. In doing so, Violet jeopardizes her engagement to her longtime sweetheart, Stanley Adamski. Meanwhile, Mother Mary Joseph, who runs the Good Shepherd, has no idea the asylum's physician, Dr. Peters, is involved in eugenics and experimenting on the girls with various sterilization techniques. 5 years later, Lily and Violet are back home in Scranton, one married, one about to be, each finding her own way in a place where a woman's worth is tied to her virtue. Barbara J. Taylor of Scranton has an MFA in creative writing from Wilkes University, and she teaches English in the Pocono Mountain School District. At Wilkes, Barbara Taylor worked with Kaylee Jones as her mentor. Kaylee Jones is a novelist, creative nonfiction writer, and editor. Her most recent novel, The Anger Meridian, was published by Akashic Books in June 2015. Her memoir, Lies My Mother Never Told Me, was released by HarperCollins in 2009. Her third novel, A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries, was adapted as a Merchant Ivory film in 1998. Currently, she chairs the James Jones First Novel Fellowship, which awards $10,000 annually to an unpublished first novel. In 2011, Kaylee Jones was given an award by the National Coalition Against Censorship for her work in bringing to print an unexpurgated, uncensored edition of her father's classic novel, From Here to Eternity. Kaylee's newest endeavor is the launch of her imprint, Kaylee Jones Books, under the aegis of Akashic Books. She is one of the foundational faculty members of the Graduate Creative Writing Program at Wilkes University, and as part of that program and its June residency, Kaylee and Barb will be presenters at the Maslow Foundation Salon Reading Series evening this Sunday, June 19th at 7 at Barnes & Noble in downtown Wilkes-Barre. Barbara Taylor and Kaylee Jones paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about their working relationship, which began in the Wilkes Graduate Creative Writing Program, and Barb's new novel, All Waiting Is Long.
I am where I am because of Kaylee and because of the Wilkes program. The Wilkes program, there's just a generosity with the faculty members that's amazing. They are almost happier for our successes, I think, than their own. They get so excited for us. What I like about the program is these are working writers, working editors, working publishers who are teaching. So they really do prepare you for the real world and for the writing life. Kaylee was my mentor She has since become my friend, of course, my publisher. And these relationships do blossom at Wilkes because of that environment that's fostered.
Barb and I became very good friends after graduation, after she graduated with her MA. She went back and got her MFA after. But after she got her MA, I didn't want her to be sort of left out there trying to figure out what to do next. So Barb started to come into New York, and I'd come visit her, and we'd hang out, and we had a little writing group going on. So both of these books went through workshops, especially the second book. The second book went through, that book went through a rigorous workshop, and I think it's a better book for the opinions and the sensibilities of the people who were in that workshop.
Kelly is an incredible writer in her own right, and she is as good a teacher as she is a writer, and that doesn't always happen. When you're writing, you really have to find a few people who you trust implicitly, and that's Kelly for me. If Kelly suggests I try something, I try it, and you know, I was going to say 99% of the time I take the advice, but honestly, I think it's 100% because she has such a keen eye. The first book, she had insomnia at one point and yes. was awake in the middle of the night and suddenly realized an idea for me to restructure. And she was absolutely right, and I went through. It took me about a year, but
Barb,
I restructured.
Barb wasn't so happy at first.
Well, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work, but she's always right. When I was writing the first book, Sing in the Morning, Cry at Night, I took all of her advice, and then toward the end, she had an idea that I just couldn't figure out how to make it work. And so I wrote the end of the book and I said, I'll try your idea when I have time, but I have to get this finished for the program. And she said, I'll read it when you try my idea. Sophie the Mule. And she was absolutely right. I went back, I rewrote. So here's the thing. You know, you have to find that person you trust and then you have to actually try it. You know, you're not obligated to keep the changes, but you should try them. And, you know, she's such a success in her own right. Why wouldn't I try what she suggests?
What makes a good editor, Kaylee?
I think I have an excellent editor who's now, she was my editor at HarperCollins, and now she's my agent. She switched because she felt that she was becoming a numbers cruncher, and her power was taken away, and she was not feeling that she was helping writers. So now she has her own company, and she understands the way I think. So when she makes a suggestion, usually it's something connected to what she already knows about me. And it's a suggestion that usually is a shortcut for me, something that I hadn't thought of, where she gives me a direction that really helps me to see exactly sort of, she doesn't influence my writing so much, but she does read the drafts and do corrections and so forth on the drafts. But she senses sort of the way I think. And that's really the best kind of editor. She really, and she's also, she's not the kind of person who walks away, who says, all right, book's done, goodbye, you know, we're done. It's a long-term relationship. And I think for the most part, that no longer exists, mostly in the publishing business. If your first novel is not an enormous success, they move on. And then you have the trouble of finding another editor, somebody else who works. That's the general rule. I have a few former students and people who've won the James Jones Society Award who have had huge successes, and their editors, of course, stay with them because they're big successes and they've sold so many copies that the editors would be fools to walk away from them. But that relationship of, oh, the book wasn't a great success, but the next one will be, that's fine, we'll stay together, that doesn't occur anymore. There isn't the money or the time. Nobody has the time or the money to do it. And that's sort of why I decided to become a publisher, was because I kept having this experience of truly, this is not the case with Barb's novel, but truly spectacular books that were not finding homes because they felt they were too literary or too midlist, or they were afraid that the audience wouldn't be happy. Well, Barb's first earlier draft, she never sent this book out as it was, finally. She just went with me and didn't send it out. But she has a fantastic agent, Chris Tomasino, whom she knows also through the program, who was her outside reader and fell in love with her work. But with the first book, people read it and Chris sent it around, the first draft from her graduation from the MA program, and said, oh, nobody wants to read about a child dying. And this is the most absurd reason to turn a book down I've ever heard in my life. And then, you know, she ended up doing a new draft that changed the structure a bit, which is that midnight, that insomnia moment I had, which took Barb a year to rewrite that book. But that book, as it stood the day that Barb handed it to me when it was completely done, that's as good as any book that was published in mainstream publishing or anywhere else in that whole entire year. And it was recognized as such by many other people besides me that it was truly a magnificent book. But Barb decided to go with me and not send it out. And Chris agreed with her that it was worth doing it that way.
You know what? I'm a school teacher. I don't know this world of publishing, and I landed in such a safe place. These people are incredible. Kaylee Jones, Johnny Temple, everybody at Akashic, at Kaylee Jones Books. It's a great place for a writer, truly.
Right, and Barb made all the decisions herself. Mm-hmm. What kind of cover do you want? What would you like it to look like? She didn't like the original cover that somebody had done that didn't really understand the book. And Barb said, you know, I don't really love this cover. Well, in mainstream publishing, well, that's too bad. Goodbye. It's going out that way. But Barb said, I'm not crazy about it. I'd like to try this. And so we went and did that. And we got the best cover we could possibly get because we had Barb's input the whole time. And the same with this one. Same idea. Barb built that cover with the designer completely from her own thoughts, and the road trips and the readings and the book clubs and the interviews and all those things very much was from the ground up, you know, very much brick and mortar. Akashic is a very New York, very urban publisher, very edgy, and they didn't know anything about Pennsylvania area, you know, northeastern Pennsylvania. So Barb and I kind of did most of that, mostly Barb, more than I.
What's been great about this book is it's almost sort of a grassroots thing. Book clubs have picked it up. And that's where I think it's taking off. And I thought originally it might just only have an appeal in Northeast PA, but it has sold all over the country. It's doing well in Canada.
New Zealand.
So it's really taken off in a way that I could never have dreamed. So I have no regrets or no qualms about any of that.
You don't really know. I never know how it's going to sell. All I know is that I think it's a great project or a great book worth publishing, and that's all I really care about. But the fact that the day that Sing in the Morning, Cry at Night came out, the first copies were in the Wilkes Barnes & Noble, and we had an evening reading on a Friday night before the residency, which was not part of the residency, but everybody was there. Well, we sold out of the book before the evening even began. So Barb had to run home and get a box of books that she had because we had run out. And that was local. They couldn't keep the book in the bookstore. So I knew right then, I said, wow, this is very special. People aren't just buying it because they know Barb or she's part of the program. People were coming from long distances. Hey, is that book in yet? Can I get that book? So that happened, which was really extraordinary.
At what point did you know there would be maybe more to tell?
Well, going back to Wilkes, when they send your book out to an outside reader, you get feedback. And the outside reader happened to be Chris Tomasino, who would eventually become my agent. So before I met with Chris, Kaylee sat down and said, now, she's an agent, so she might be interested, but she's going to ask you what you're working on. And I wasn't working on anything else. I was still working on that. So she said, tell her it's a trilogy. And that short story you wrote for class, tell her that's a contemporary novel that you're working on. So I had that in my head, and I went to the meeting, and she asked, and I told her about both projects, and she said, I'd love to see them. And I said, well, how about we just focus on the first book? But after that, I got to thinking about it, and really, I thought my characters had more to say. The second book and the third book, when it's written, they're all standalones. So it's not like you have to read book one in order to get book two. But I like that they're about the characters, the same characters. I like that you're meeting them at a different point in their lives. And so that's where it came from.
And there's a perfect example of working with someone who knows the terrain, as you do, Kaylee.
Barb had mentioned somewhere along the line that she had these ideas about these huge events in Scranton history. And they were almost about 20 years apart. The first one was the Billy Sunday snowstorm, which is the end of the first book. The second one was the change toward unionizing of the mines, which was in the early 30s. And then the third one was the flood of 1955. And so these were the three major events that Barb was kind of thinking about. And I thought, well, that's the trilogy right there, is this family going, you know, you see them 20 years later in each case. It couldn't have been better. It's perfect. You couldn't even make it up, right?
You're from here, yes?
Born and bred. I've lived in Scranton my whole life. Lived in the Poconos for a little while as a teacher, but I'm from Scranton. I love Scranton, and I like to think of Scranton almost as a character in my novels to get a sense of the people, for better and for worse. I can't see setting these novels anyplace else.
There is an awful lot that we can experience in All Waiting Is Long about something that many people have forgotten about or may not even know about, and that certainly is eugenics.
And that's a so-called science suggesting that humankind can be improved through selective breeding.
And you found that in your research about what was happening at that time.
Right. I did find it in the research. I didn't have that in mind when I started, but as I was going along, I kept coming across these sermons that were promoting eugenics and promoting the white race and promoting country fairs would have fitter family contests to see which white family was genetically better than the others. And I was fascinated by this because we always hear about Hitler and his focus on eugenics, but we were really pushing that in our country before Hitler. And in fact, some of his people were using our research for their own studies. And it wasn't really until Hitler was seen as the great evil that he was that we sort of pulled back on all of that. But we really do have a dark history as far as eugenics is concerned. So I liked that. I wanted to explore that a little bit. And even in Scranton, I have a scene at the Century Club, and I placed it at the Century Club because I like the setting. And then when I did some research, I discovered that they did have some speakers on that movement. And so it was, you know, one of many places. So we were really promoting that at the time.
There are lots of resonances here. It's not just set back then, right?
Well, I think when you write historical fiction, you do that. So I don't want to explore modern problems. I don't want to give the book a modern sensibility. But there are so many really recurring issues that through history keep cropping up. And yes, eugenics is still something that we deal with today. It's not quite as obvious, but it's out there. So that, unions, prostitution, all of the themes that are sort of recurring. The book opens at the Good Shepherd Infant Asylum for wayward girls. We're still out there condemning women for their sexuality. So all of those themes are recurring. And so even though they're dated in the sense that this is how they were treated in the 1930s, we're still dealing with those issues today.
I was going to say the best historical fiction obviously resounds for the reader in terms of modern issues and problems, and I think that really resonates for me. What I thought was really interesting was that they're very Protestant, but in Scranton, where these people come from, there is no place for a pregnant teenager to go. They have to go to the Catholics in Philadelphia because the Catholics have the asylums and the orphanages for children who are going to be given up for adoption, not the Protestants, which is so interesting, I think. And, you know, how that plays out in the book. They go to this place and the nun is absolutely fantastic. She's just wonderful. And that made me think about that, too. You know, the idea that there is great forgiveness in Christianity, you know, this nun who takes in these women who are pregnant. And it's so funny, they call them the Protestants. They say, the Protestants are here, you know, which is very amusing. But to think about what in 1930 a woman's choices were, if she did not have the option to marry the young man, and what would she be able to do? And the idea that eugenics, you know, there's a certain character in here who feels it's his godly responsibility to stop these women from getting pregnant, and that he doesn't even offer them a choice. It's taken away from them because he knows best. So once you're implying that eugenics is a good thing, then you're implying that whatever your idea of good is the rule. And that's what Hitler did. You know, well, that person's IQ is below this. So that person, we're going to just get rid of that person. So where's the line? And what is godly about that? Because last time I looked, humans were not God. You know, God is God. And God's not the one making those decisions, certainly.
And that's what we want in good fiction. We want to be able to meet compelling characters and have a compelling story unfold. But we also want to be stimulated and challenged and ask those questions. And they evolve out of getting to know these characters and their lives and what they're faced with.
Yeah, I see it as an evolution. I hope I never get preachy.
You never do.
Thank you. No. I also hope that I don't even put my own opinions out there. I would really like to think that people can read the book and discuss it. For example, with the first book, Billy Sunday is in the book, a famous evangelist from the time, and I had people who were fundamentalist Christians who said to me, you did such a great job of showing who he was. And then I also had friends who were atheists who said, you did a great job of showing who he was. So it's that idea that I put it on the page and then you interpret it. I don't want to tell people what to think.
We ended up having a very interesting discussion over that because we had a friend who read it, and she's very anti-organized religion, she's a spiritual person, but she said, you have to take a stand here. You have to make a statement about Billy Sunday. And Barb and I talked about this a long time, and Barb said, no, I'm just showing you what he was like and what that day was like. It's not my position here. I don't want to do that. And we ended up sticking with Barb's plan, and I think it came out just wonderfully.
I think if you go in with an agenda, then your book is heavy-handed. And so I didn't have the eugenics agenda. I didn't have any of that. It evolved, and so I would like to think it's a more natural progression.
From the last book and in this book, you have a beautiful sense of word choice and capturing the way people talk. That's something that just comes from having heard stories and met people and having an ear.
I think so. As a kid, my favorite thing was to be at adult gatherings and listen to the stories. And I have notes in this big old Tupperware bin from when I was a little girl, from maybe at the age of 7 on. So I was always listening. I do remember at one point I thought I would love to be a writer. This was when I was in high school, and I thought, but I can't write dialogue. And I started listening intentionally, and I think that helped. And plus at Wilkes, you take two foundation courses, so I took fiction, but I also took playwriting because I wanted to work on the dialogue. And I do think the trick with dialogue is, in real life, we don't listen and answer exactly. It's not the straight back and forth. We wait until it's our turn and then say what we have on our minds. And so if you look at the conversation, there's never a, hi, how are you? I'm fine, how are you? Life doesn't work that way. Plus, locally, I mean, you hear, there's just such a richness, I think, to the people in Scranton and the phrasing and just the syntax, all of it. I love it. It's like music. And so I guess I hear that. And I hear it in my head before I put it on the page.
The first time we met, Barb and I, we have this sort of round robin thing where we get to talk to all the students about their projects. And Barb sat down with me at lunch, you know, 12 o'clock in the cafeteria, and said, this is for the first novel, Sing in the Morning. This is my idea. This is what I'm working on. I have this idea for a chorus, a church ladies chorus. We started talking. We were talking. Next thing, I looked up. The place was completely empty. Everybody had left. The next class was already in session, and we were still sitting there, and it was an hour and a half later, and I thought, wow, this hasn't happened to me in years. So I ran to Bonnie and said, I really want to work with Barb if she will work with me, because I'm very interested. And the thing that caught my eye was the church ladies. And then Barb added this fantastic how-to thing, you know, the little how-tos, how to stay awake in church, how to clean, you know, this thing or that thing. And for this book, we were struggling with trying to figure out, I had another one of those sleepless nights, and I was thinking about it, and it suddenly occurred to me that if you could find a book that was around that time, 1929, 1930, of advice for women about sexuality and marriage. And so Barb was going up an escalator, I think, and I started yelling, I know what it has to be. It has to be a book on women's sexuality from 1929, an advice book. And Barb's waving and yelling, good idea.
Right. No, that's exactly it. That was it, sex. That was exactly what it needed. But it's the way women were taught about sexuality, their sexuality, in the late 20s, early 30s. So you definitely get that different point of view.
And it's a man, of course, wrote the book. And right. He's a doctor. And he's doing the best he can. Clearly, he thinks he's telling you what you really need to know.
And by the way, all of the books that I looked at about sexuality and really the medical books at the time were printed by eugenics presses. So that was another.
Wow.
I just kept running across that term. And it makes sense because on one hand, they were out there trying to, you know, make sure that women are healthy when they give birth and all of those things. And that's great. But then, of course, they took it to the dark side. So that's why it was in the medical books. That's why it was in the books on sexuality.
And in fact, you open chapter one with a quote.
I like those. In the first book, I include them because with historical fiction, I think you run the risk of what we call info dumps, where you're doing all of this research and you think everybody in the world wants to know every nitty-gritty detail about the research. And those are the paragraphs you skip over when you're reading. I wanted to give you a sense of the time without really going on and on in the book. So I thought just those pithy little helpful hints were a way to place you in that time period. And I think it does it again in the second book, or at least I hope so, because you can tell this is not the advice we would give women today. And then it eventually takes a dark turn because the advice was coming from the eugenicists.
And what about relationships and the characters? Introduce us a little bit to Violet and Lily. Sisters,
right.
Sisterhood is something that's very important.
It is. In the second book, All Waiting is Long, it opens at the Good Shepherd Infant Asylum in Philadelphia with Violet and her sister Lily. And sisters are very important, that relationship. In fact, I dedicated the book to my sister Alice. And really, what they have to do ultimately is decide between duty and desire. And, you know, women really didn't have the choices then that hopefully we have now. And it's set against the backdrop of, you know, the Good Shepherd Infant Asylum is for wayward girls. So obviously one of them is pregnant. So what do you do in that situation? 5 years later, it flashes ahead. They're back in Scranton and they have to decide between love and duty. And sometimes those are two separate entities. And that's set against the backdrop of the coal mine strikes and rampant prostitution that was going on in Scranton at the time. I mean, we had quite a red light district. And, of course, the eugenics movement.
You write so well about mother, daughter in your most recent book, Kaylee. When we see the complexity of the relationship, it's so important for readers to understand that it's gray and that sometimes there are these marvelous moments, and you do that so well. Do people get that?
I fear that the soundbite has taken over the world and people's ability to focus on things is so much narrower than it used to be. So especially in television, not all television, in film, it's simplified. It's black, it's white. The hero wears a white hat, the bad guy wears a black hat, and it's very simplified. And I think that relationships, especially family relationships, are very, very intertwined and complex. And I think it's Catherine Ann Porter in Pale Horse, Pale Rider in the first few pages says, the family was intertwined like badly cast fishing lines just under the water. And that's so perfect, because how do you unravel or unknot a badly cast bunch of fishing lines? And that always stayed with me, because that's exactly what it is. So you can follow the threads and sort of see the complex connections, but in a lot of ways, you just leave it alone and try to write about it. But I learned also very much from Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and the Russians and Chekhov from that period that two conflicting emotions can coexist at the same time. And we've forgotten that in our literature very often. That's called ambivalence, not ambiguity, but ambivalence, where a dark and a light emotion can coexist at the same time. And I think in a lot of ways, forgotten that. And Barb does that beautifully in her book, too, that the older sister has, you know, anger and resentment toward the younger sister who's been spoiled and has had life so easy, where she's been working and working. And she adores her, too. So those two things can coexist. It doesn't have to be simply one thing or the other.
Barb, you were nodding about the ambivalence.
I think of Fitzgerald. That really is my inspiration for that idea of holding those two emotions in your head at the same time. You know, I love the chorus of church women. As gossipy and mean-spirited as they can be, they're also well-intentioned, and these are people I know. Let's face it, sometimes we are them. You know, they're human.
And they'll be the first ones to show up if there's a death or a funeral or a problem. They're the first ones at the door with the food and to help, and so they have good hearts. You know, they gossip a little too much, but they mean well.
I wish we were not just on radio, because when you both came and sat at the table and saw the copy, All Waiting is Long, on the table, you were just both so delighted and thrilled to see it in print and in paper and bound and there. Tell us about the title. Tell us a little bit about the elephant and the eBay experience.
Well, yeah, we were excited because the book comes out July 1st, so we haven't seen a copy yet, so it's pretty exciting. The title is an old Welsh proverb, All Waiting is Long, and I really liked the feel of it, and as I was progressing in the story, there are so many moments when waiting, whether it's for something good or something not so good, sort of come up in the story, and I actually use the quote. As a teacher, my students always want to know where the title came from, so I always make sure I include it in the story. The elephant in 1926, Queenie the elephant came to Scranton. The children in all the schools donated to bring the first elephant to Naog Zoo. And there's a scene with Queenie the elephant, and so I wanted to use the elephant on the cover. But then the elephant also comes to represent, I think, maybe lost love. There are some mentions later on that I don't want to really get into, but it came from that. Queenie the elephant died in 1935, and that's when we got Tilly. and her friend Joshua the donkey. So we had a long history of elephants at the Naog Zoo, but that's where that comes from. And then it's filled again with pictures. Actually, I'm really lucky because most people don't get to have a hand in the design. But because the pictures inspire me so much for the stories, we've included them on the cover. So they are pictures from my church and pictures from my family. And I needed a nun, and I didn't have one. And we had to deal with public domain and all of that. So I actually bought a nun on eBay. And so the picture of the nun, I don't know the woman, but I hope she lived a good life, and she's there to represent. So it all worked out.
Writers Barbara J. Taylor and Kaylee Jones talking with us about their working relationship and Barb's new novel, All Waiting is Long, due out July 5th through the Kaylee Jones book imprint of Akashic Books. It's the sequel to Barb's critically acclaimed debut novel, Sing in the Morning, Cry at Night. Barbara Taylor and Kaylee Jones will take part in a reading this Sunday evening, June 19th, at Barnes & Noble in downtown Wilkes-Barre as part of the Maslow Foundation Salon Reading Series at the start of the June residency of the Wilkes University Graduate Creative Writing Program. And that's at 7 o'clock, and there will be readings nightly, June 19th through the 23rd, and they are open to the public free of charge. The opening night on Sunday is at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore at Public Square, 7 South Main Street, and then subsequent readings will take place at the Dorothy Dixon Dart Center at Wilkes University, and that is 84 West South Street in Wilkes-Barre on the campus. All readings start at 7. For more information, on the web, wilkes.edu, wilkes.edu. In addition, there will be a book launch for All Waiting is Long in Scranton at Love the Arts, 300 Lackawanna Avenue, and that's Friday, July 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. A book launch in Scranton on Friday, July 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. at Love the Arts, 300 Lackawanna Avenue. For more information, barbarajtaylor.com, barbarajtaylor.com.